Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Let's get this cheese, you know what I'm saying?
Hello.
Do you mean it? Are you really saying hello? Is it really happening?
It's time for hello. What's up, y'all? This is the Heritage Radio Network Week in Review, where we distill and condense and present all of the wonderful things happening network-wide to you in this digestible 22-minute-ish format. My name is Jack Inslee. I'm the executive producer here at Heritage Radio Network, and I am joined by the one and only...
Oh, I say my name.
I like you to introduce
yourself.
I do it now.
I'm Aaron Fairbanks, Executive Director of the Heritage Radio Network, coming on with a tentative parsing step into this week's Week in Review, but it's going to get better, guys. Promise. Stick with us. We got a great show.
Yeah, we're both like about to travel really any minute now, so we're in that kind of frantic last minute.
I'm here. I'm totally here. I'm here for you guys.
I speak
out
for
there
myself.
Listening. Thank you for coming to join us. It's going to be good. We are going to take good care of you.
So the way we like to start this is by discussing the last good bite that we had. And Aaron, I'll let you kick it off. What's the last good bite you had?
Well, my last good bite was actually a drink. It was at 1 or 8, this Japanese joint over in Williamsburg. And they have this amazing little kind of tea pop up there. It's a guy, Stefan Ramirez, who has a business called Tea Dealers. You can find him at teadealers.com. And he is their in-house tea sommelier. I'm sure there's actually a more official word for it, but I neglected to learn that because I was so distracted by this amazing mugwort tea sommelier that I got to enjoy. It was like this... It tasted like a green tea. It was totally a tea sound. It's because apparently they process the mugwort in the same way that green tea is processed. It just, like, literally just hit the U.S. It hasn't even been bagged and put on the counter yet. I have to go by next week to pick some up because it was that delicious. And you guys should, too. They're over at 66 South 2nd Street in Brooklyn. You can also find them online to place your order. It was elegant and beautiful and delicious and everything you want the end of a dinner drink to be.
Wow, that sounds great.
It
and
was amazing.
I'm doing some research here. It seems that we're actually calling them tea sommeliers.
Really?
I don't think you have a new word to learn. I mean, tell me I'm wrong. Tweet us, write us, but... From what I can gather here,
I'm going to
check articles online.
Akiko from Japan Eats. I'm like, I have a feeling the Japanese
word,
are not calling it. They're like, first you took our matcha and you put it in a goddamn latte,
no.
And now you're calling our tea folks it's sommeliers. Get it together,
I'm
America.
Really sorry. I only speak for the domestic language here. But it seems to be quite the trending topic. A lot of articles here, New York Times, NPR, Modern Farmer. A lot of people talking about tea sommeliers. So.
Well, here we go.
So
stumbled
it
into it.
I'm continuing the year of cooking in, channeling my inner Kathy Irway, and the last delicious thing I made was a very, very simple lemon lentil soup recipe, which was a Marcus Samuelson recipe, or rather a Michelle Wolfson recipe on Marcus Samuelson's website, something he tweeted out. And it was one of those like pantry clearing recipes, which was really nice. I'm like, wait a minute. Onions. I've got onions. I've got garlic. Oh, I've got some old coconut oil. Like everything they called for I had and kind of needed to get rid of lasted me through the week. Very simple, very easy, very delicious, and vegetarian, which I'm also trending towards lately. So big ups to the Marcus Samuelson Empire. Thank you for that. Really helped me this week. That being said, why don't we transition to the studio and hear some clips? Ah, yes. So, another wonderful week at Heritage Radio Network. As you know, if you know us, there are plenty of shows happening every week covering all different types of topics. And one that really caught my ear was a conversation on Food Talk with Mike Colomeco. So Victoria James, the guest, and Mike Colomeco were speaking to the oversaturation of sommeliers, or rather just like how there are so many more sommeliers today. So I want to play this clip and then we will react.
So I go back to the say, 80s, 90s, those two decades. In all of New York City, I don't think there were six restaurants with soms on the floor. There just weren't. It just wasn't a job title. No one, it just, there wasn't the interest, there wasn't the money. You trained your servers to do this stuff or whatever. And then in the aughts, somehow, it just began to go tick, 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 and now the volume's at like 11, where you can't be taken seriously as a restaurant without a great beverage program, a dope wine list, and probably a som. Is there going to be like an oversaturation?
Well, you know, it's hard to say and it's hard to predict, but there is definitely, you know, every restaurant now has multiple sommeliers or a ton, and there definitely is a challenge in order to find work as a sommelier, and not only that, but an ideal job and an ideal situation. But, you know, competition's always good, and it's always good for the industry to a certain extent. And as long as people love what they do and there is that authenticity, I think that there will always be work for that sommelier. And then, you know, the people that, you know, don't give their all, you know, unfortunately, maybe there won't be jobs for them, but that's not the worst thing either.
Yeah, and you, I mean, clearly you've had like a
survival of the fittest.
Well
wow,
put.
Yeah. I feel like it's going to be good for diners. I mean, how can like more beverage expertise be bad for diners?
Yeah, absolutely. As long as the kind of standards don't change, I'm totally good with it. I mean, my move, my pro tip when I go out, always ask the somm. I am in no position to pick a bottle of wine off of a list. Pretty much ever. I always, you know, so, I mean, you know, you might know you like one thing, but your somm knows, they're eating the food, they're drinking the wine, they know what's there, put your trust in their hands.
Your wine somm, your tea somm, your water somm.
Oh.
I mean, I could see how it can get ridiculous. I don't know if we're there yet. Mike will definitely keep us in the loop, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Keeping it in the restaurant industry, we've got a brand new show on the network called Front Burner with some new hosts to the network, Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat and Andrew Friedman from Tokeland. If you're familiar with the food world, you probably know those two names. If not, you should check the show out and learn more about them. So on their debut episode, they talked with Chef Gavin Kaysen about kind of these big name chefs taking their talents to smaller cities and why that's happening a lot lately. So let's hear what Gavin has to say about that.
You know, it's funny. It used to be if you wanted to be a big name chef in the United States, it was almost like wanting to be an actor, right? The advice was you wanted to come to New York, you wanted to go to LA, maybe Chicago. You know, there were a couple of big cities where kind of all the action was, right?
Yep.
And now it feels like, well, maybe in those traditionally huge markets there is, but that there's a lot of room in. You know, I don't know what a non-offensive way to put it, but, you know, you hear chefs talk about, like, second markets or, other cities that weren't traditionally thought of as food hubs, right?
Sure, yeah. I think it also points back to the conversation about relevancy. I mean, would I have been as relevant in New York as I am in Minneapolis? I don't think so. I mean, here I can create a different point of view that people are willing to listen to, and a lot of people are willing to listen to it because it's very different than what is the norm around where I am. And it's not, you know, I didn't make the move because of that reason, but that just sort of happened and became what it is. I think that there's a lot of incredible chefs in those big cities, and to work in a city like New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles or Chicago, I think it's important for your career. I think you have to do it. I think you should do it. And if it's the right place for you and you want to live there, then stay there. If it's not and you want to move back home to Minneapolis or to Detroit or to Nashville because that's where you grew up, then you have the opportunity to do that now because there are investors in all of those cities that are willing to give you money because you're going to pay $10, $15 a square foot for a space that you can build out for a quarter of what it'll cost in that bigger city that you were just at. You know, now, granted, you can't.
Whew. Yeah. I mean, this is like a part of an ongoing conversation. It's interesting to hear from a chef who was working for, you know, with such an amazing restaurant group here in the city and is now striking out on his own and getting that like space to really experiment. I actually just ran into a woman I used to cook with at Gramercy last night who just got back after 4 years in Dubai.
Whoa.
Yeah. And she's like, oh, I think I want to open something. But she's like, the more I looked around the New York market, the more I was like, there's just like too much competition here. And so she's on her way to Hong Kong to like continue the global journey. And I was just, I mean, it's out there. It's a big part of the conversation.
Well, you know, as they say, if you can make it here in New York, you can make it anywhere. That's always like, you know, when I tell people that are
yeah,
leaving, I'm
help,
like, you'll be good. You'll make it. You'll be fine.
I'd rather decide to like not open a place and go make it somewhere else than like open a place and be like, I did it. I'm millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt and like walking away. All of America deserves good food, so let's bring it. Bring it on out.
And more of it's out there. Erin, maybe you want to introduce this third clip. There's a brand new Farm Report host. This is, of course, your program that you've hosted for quite some time now, and you're stepping down for a little bit. And maybe you want to orient us to...
Well, we have Holly Cederholm is taking over as the new host of the Farm Report. Holly has a long background in agriculture with a particular focus on seeds, and which are essentially the origin story of all ag. So she connected in her very first interview around this subject. And
We're talking about where seeds come from.
Right. But the guest is...
Ken Green.
Ken Green.
Yeah. Here we go. Here's the clip.
And I started to realize that a whole part of the food world was left out of the conversation around local food. And that was, where do the seeds come from?
Yeah, everything starts with a seed.
You know, who's growing the seeds? How are they growing? You know, what are we supporting from our plate beyond the food? What's behind that? And so that sort of started my interest in finding out about seeds. And the more I found out about the corporate seed industry and genetic engineering and the way that seeds are controlled and the loss of genetic diversity and consolidation of seed resources and all these like huge global issues, it's like, wow, there's all this stuff going on that when we're eating or even our farmers aren't aware of. And so I wanted to start doing something to try and open up that world to people.
Thinking like raw ingredients. See, it's funny because seeds are something we like literally put in a vault, like in the middle of the earth to protect. It was a thing when you were migrating from place to place throughout millennia, you would bring with you to preserve part of like your culture and agriculture of home. This is a great episode. I think later that night, there was a talk on the same issue over at MOFAD looking at this really interesting story that's coming out of Glenwood on Hank's Beans. You should definitely check them out, glenwood.org. It's like a fascinating, really local to New York story on this amazing bean that was developed here in the Hudson Valley. You can actually get a taste of that farmers are just growing out for the first time this year.
Whoa.
Yeah. Lots of seed happenings.
Fresh. Let's plant another seed of conversation and move on to the breakdown. We've got a special guest on the phone. Okay, that is very epic. I like that. It orients us well. This is the breakdown where we kind of jump into a timely topic with a guest, and I hear a guest on the phone.
I hear a guest. Before we bring him in, I want to start with a little bit of a dramatic reading. The lady had dropped her napkin. More accurately, she had hurled it to the floor in a fit of disillusionment. Her small protest against the slow creep of mediocrity and miscues during a four-hour dinner at Per Se that would cost us close to $3,000. Opening lines of this gangbuster review by Pete Wells came out in the New York Times January 12th. We wanted to know what to think about it. We are on the line with Joshua David Stein, who is the food critic for The Observer, former Heritage Radio Network host. Josh,
And maybe future.
Fingers crossed. We never like to say goodbye. We just like to say see you later.
Yeah.
T- tell us, you know, how do we critique the critic? What do we think about this review?
I think the first thing to think about is the context in which Pete Wells is writing it. I think a lot of critics and a lot of the public know as well that negative reviews do much better than positive reviews, and extremism, as we see in politics, and it's the same in food writing, extremism does much better than kind of a nuanced and balanced approach. So I'm not saying that his review is inaccurate in any way, but I think it's also useful to think about the pressures that might be pushing it one way or the other, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think, you know, second review of 2016, when I checked at noon on the New York Times website, there was 643 comments going back and forth about this review. This is actually, you know, so...
And now it's up to 800.
Yeah, so and it's 2 o'clock, so it's been 2 hours. Obviously a hot topic. People are out there talking about it. You know, Per Se opened in the early 2000s, was first reviewed by the New York Times in 2011 by Sam Sifton. It got a 4-star review. I mean, when we think about taking something from a 4-star to a 2-star, you know, obviously restaurants have to continue to like earn their cred. But as a critic, when you're going into a place and you're like, oof, this is going to be a big one. I mean, does it change how you're eating in the restaurant, how you're kind of like understanding
What's going to happen?
It's going to be like, a big one. If I know if I'm Pete Wells and I'm like, all right, yep, it's time to review Per Se again, and I go there and my first meal is not great, and I'm like, oh, maybe it's a one off, and I go again and I'm like, ugh.
Yeah.
You know what changes for you when you're like, this is, you know, do you like amp up the drama of your writing? I mean, is that what you're saying, or because you're like, happening? What do you do?
I don't know if you amp up the drama, but definitely when you have very high expectations going in, and in the case of the New York Times, it was a critic from that institution which gave it 4 stars. So when you go and you're disappointed, you're not just operating from a neutral zone. So you're not operating from zero, you're operating from this should be excellent, so then you're subtracting from that. And I think that's right. I mean, I think that's it got 4 stars for a reason, and so if it's fallen, then you have the double sort of disappointment of it not being good and it not living up to what it was. You know, I think, just to think, you said this was the second review of 2016, so I guess the first one was Senior Frogs, which was another pan, but that pan was for a kind of an expected target. And I just wonder to myself, you know, is Pete Wells insulating himself from possible critiques that he's going after the easy, low-hanging fruit that's Senior Frogs? And so to fend off that, he's going off the highest of the high. I guess my point is, regardless of the accuracy of the article, and I'm sure that it is very accurate, and he's a very good writer and a wonderful critic, I think you have to think about the context of what he's choosing to review, you know, as you evaluate this specific review.
Can I ask you a question, Josh? Why was Senior Frogs reviewed?
I mean, if I had to put myself in Pete Wells' shoes, and I also wrote a review of Senior Frogs, I mean,
fair enough.
I went to Senior Frogs like the night after for New York Magazine and spent like 8 hours there.
Really?
Yeah. For a couple of reasons, but if I had to put myself in Pete Wells' shoes, it's like you're in the newsroom, you're with a bunch of folks who are interested in driving traffic, right, and buzz. They see that he did that Guy Fieri review a couple of years ago, I think in like 2012, maybe? It was a long time ago. That went gangbusters as well. It's the same sort of kind of crossover between food and drink and pop culture, and I think, you know, as media strives to stay relevant, so too does Pete Wells. So he's going to try to start the year off with a bang, you know?
Yeah, I guess I feel like, to me, you can make that argument a little more cleanly for, like, Ryan Sutton and the Per Se review from 2014 where you know, like, yeah, we're going to try and do something that's going to be, like, hot and get a lot of eyeballs. But this is, like, the New York Times. So I guess there's like something that bumps me out a little bit about that interpretation. And is that a I mean, is that a sign of changing times? The, like, you know, chasing eyeballs versus just kind of, I don't know what, like, you actually did a really interesting conversation, episode 7 of your show, kind of with Adam Platt on the role of the critic. So is it, in there you kind of pose the question, is the role of the critic to kind of discover new and introduce new and exciting talent? Is it to compare and contrast the old and keep them up to spec? I mean, if we take a bigger step back and we're looking across these different platforms, from Eater to the New York Times, the Observer, New York Magazine, is the role of critic different when you're Pete Wells at New York Times than when you're Ryan Sutton at Eater? Does it matter? Should it matter?
I think there's two things to think about. One, in each of those cases, in New York Times, in Eater, at New York Magazine, if I remember correctly, and it would be great if it was at the Observer if we had, you know, any budget. You have two sets of critics, right? You have the Pete Wells-ish critic, and then you have the sort of like Legea Michon, I think is how you pronounce her name. The Hungry City critic. And so or you have Ryan Sutton, who's a Pete Wells figure, and you have Robert Sietsma, who's the more discovery-geared critic. So they've bifurcated those two roles. And I do actually think that the role of a Pete Wells is to do these big marquee kind of like quote-unquote important restaurants, and not so much to be discovering new underground cuisine as to be evaluating, you know, evaluating the restaurants everyone's already talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly the Times has a material impact on a restaurant. But if you look at most of his reviews, everyone's mostly heard of those places. You know, there's no discovery there.
Right, right.
And to answer your other question about it bums you out about the Times, I mean, the Times is no different than any other publication that struggles for relevancy and struggles. I mean, that's not a jab at the Times, but, you know, is concerned with relevancy, is concerned with getting eyeballs, is concerned with making a splash. It's the same, like I said up top, it's the same kind of unvirtuous cycle that leads to extremism in politics, and which you see as in media, that everyone's angling to make the bigger splash in the more sensational way. I will say about the Times as well, though, it's like, they have a review like this, and then when you look in the rest of the dining section, there's a ton of really substantive, you know, content. So it's not just that they do this and this is it. It's kind of, maybe this is how they get people in and engaged, and then they kind of move around the experience and, you know, consume maybe more wholesome content. I don't know how to put it.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously you have the things that, like, you're going to put in your shopping basket every week, and then you have, like, the treats. Well, kind of one more question and then we'll let you go. One of the kind of conversations on Twitter, and there are a couple of different threads around this article, but one that stuck out to me is a number of people feeling validated. Helen Rossner in particular, she was kind of like, she talks about having a meal at Per Se and feeling, she's an editor over at Eater, feeling like, she's like, I didn't like it, but I didn't know if I was, like, allowed to say that because it's Per Se. There's something in the role of critic to kind of validate or invalidate the experience of the diner, like, in the seat.
Yeah, see, I kind of have a problem with that, though, from the inception. It's like, if she didn't feel like she had a good experience, who gives a fuck what Pete Wells has to say?
Right.
Like, her taste is her taste, her experience is her experience, and the critic's experience is a critic's experience. I would just urge that everyone understand that taste and experience is their own, and it doesn't need to be validated by anyone else. I mean, I think when you take a look at it that way, you read Pete's review and it's entertaining, you know, but that doesn't mean that you can't have a wonderful meal and a totally different experience than that. I think that's, like, what Helen's talking about seems a little bit, it has to do with us surrendering our sort of sense of confidence in our own taste. Like, you don't need an expert to tell you.
Right. And, in her defense, she does say that she was, like, it was kind of in the evolution of her building her own kind of confidence and feeling of standing as a person who works and writes professionally in food. And, you know, she's not a food critic.
Right.
And I think she was, like, sharing that story in what I thought was, like, a very sweet and interesting way. And in a way that I feel like a lot of people experience fine dining, where they're like, man, I didn't have a good time. It must be my fault. Which
right.
is, I think, really the thing that kept kind of stick, that Pete kept really, like, bringing up in the review is, like, kind of, like, you were treating... There was, like, moments where he felt like he was being treated a little bit, like, dickish. And
yeah.
I'm like, that's not cool.
The only thing I would say there is, you know... This is what actually happened, right? But what would have happened if Pete wrote a stellar review, a four-stellar review, quadruple stellar review
right.
of Per Se? Would that in any way invalidate Helen's feelings? And I would argue, no, she had that experience. It's her experience, and it's true for her, you know? So just surrendering that power to a critic to validate or invalidate one's opinions, I think it's a little bit dangerous. Maybe I just argued myself out of a job, but the way I look at it is I'm providing entertainment just like Pete is, and someone happens to think that it's worth being published, but that doesn't mean at all, you know, that I can ever speak for anyone else
yeah.
or should speak for anyone.
Disagree with your critics.
It's okay.
It's okay. Thank you so much, Josh, for taking a few minutes and talking to us. We miss you here. We love having you in here in the loop and getting your perspective.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you so much. So we're going to move on and give some events to you all this week because there are a few really good ones going on. I want to start off by saying that BJ Dennis is somebody that we've had our eyes on for a little while now because we will be at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival, and he is a Charleston man, and he kind of specializes in some of his cooking paying homage to the Gullah Geechee culture, and he's coming to Brooklyn. Unfortunately, I won't be here this weekend. I don't think Aaron will be here this weekend, but you should definitely go check him out if you're in the New York area. It's Thursday, January 14th to Saturday, January 16th. They're taking reservations at Lucy's Kitchen from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. So definitely put that on your calendar if you don't have it there already. And I know, Aaron, MOFAD's been catching your eye lately.
MOFAD, Museum of Food and Drink, the New York City's very first museum dedicated exclusively to food and drink. They just announced their winter programming lineup, and it is pretty exciting. So if you're in New York, if you're planning a trip to New York, definitely want to put them on your stop. They're doing a number of things focused around combat cuisine, kind of then and now. So what were people eating? What were we feeding our soldiers? What are we feeding soldiers of the future? How are we looking at easy to pack, you know, ready to eat meals, rations that will fuel like our soldiers out on the battlefield? Lots of different kind of one-off events, talks, a chance to taste some of the meals. And then if you have kids, they've got a wonderful lineup of children's programming. I think the most exciting might be for those of you who are Cronut fans out of there. You can kind of bring your kids in to hang with Dominique and Sel and get, cooking lessons from the pastry master himself, and your kids get to walk home with their very own custom chocolate sauce.
Why would you say Cronut out loud in front of me? You know I'm off pastries.
I feel like 8-year-old pastry chef in me is like, yo, I want to do that. When is the adult class?
For real, right?
And more just to say like that they have a standing exhibit right now looking at kind of the intersection of the chemical industry and the flavor industry, and it's fascinating. So lots of special programming, but the regular exhibit, which is open Monday to Friday, check them out, mofad.org. Just really cool stuff.
Absolutely. And with that, let's close the show with some big ups. And as always, a thank you to the band Big Ups for that little jingle. This is the point of the show where we like to just shout somebody out for being great, doing good stuff. I'm gonna kick it off. this is a group, the a couple rather, sorry, that's been on the network plenty of times over the years. Allison and Matt Robicelli, who, along with kind of the Do or Dine scratch bread wave, did close their Brooklyn shop, their cupcake shop. They're famous for these cupcakes, Robicelli's cupcakes, and they had announced that they were going to be moving to Baltimore. So there was a lot of press coming from Allison herself talking about how you just can't make it in New York as a small business, and we're moving to Baltimore. And a lot of people were upset about that, but she kind of came back with a right hook on this. Basically, they're going to be opening 100 stores globally, including locations in New York.
What?
So, yeah, this was definitely a fake out on her part. So, you know, she followed up by saying, like, yeah, we can't make it small in New York, so we're going to make it big everywhere. It was just, I'm so stoked for them. They're hilarious, real deal Brooklyn cats. Really great to see that they're taking a big step forward and not just like a small left turn. So look for Robicelli's everywhere across the globe, apparently. Just announced an eater today. So out to Allison and Matt Robicelli.
Oh, man. That sounds sweet. Wah, wah.
Aha.
I got to give a shout out to Sarah Wiener, who runs the Good Food Awards, which are kicking off this weekend out in the Bay Area. Good Food Awards recognize small, medium scale producers who are making the kind of food you want to eat. Excellent beers, coffees, jams, charcuterie, oils, you know, pantry items. The Good Food Awards is a chance to kind of celebrate and recognize producers who are doing it different, who are looking at traceability, who are looking at really responsible procurement, and who are looking at really artisanally crafted and produced products. The Good Food Awards ceremony is going to actually be available as a rebroadcast. So if you are not out in the Bay Area, if you did not grab tickets, you can still listen to some really amazing remarks by the folks of Carlo Petrini, founder of Slow Food, Nell Newman, who runs ran Newman Organics but now runs the Newman Foundation, Alice Waters. They have like kind of a powerhouse, you know, Michael Pollan, the who's who of the kind of good food movement is going to be hanging out, as you would imagine, at the Good Food Awards, and we're going to be bringing you some live coverage of that event. So stay tuned. We will let you know where to find it next week on the show. Definitely check our event listings at www.heritageradionetwork.org to stay up on all the stuff we got going on. And big ups to Sarah for being awesome, for putting together an amazing event year after year, jam-packed. I can literally not believe the amount of activities that this woman puts into one weekend, and I'm really excited to get out there and have a taste.
Crushing it. I'm excited for you to be there. I'm excited that we all get to hear it and relive it. That's super awesome. I will be in New Orleans, so if you happen to hear this and happen to be in New Orleans from late tonight until Tuesday, holler at me. Either Heritage_Radio on Twitter or Jack Inslee at Twitter. I'll be making the rounds in the food and beverage world. So anyway, thank you to Liz so much for engineering this show. And Aaron, thank you. And Joshua David Stein, thank you so much for joining us. This is The Week in Review. Subscribe on iTunes. Listen on heritageradionetwork.org. The show page has much more than the podcast. It's like a visual podcast accompaniment. We'll see y'all next week. Peace.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.